Hello again. I'm Dan Lebatard. You know, this is a new little project for us, Lebatard and Friends, Lebatard AF, South Beach Sessions. All of it is growing and trickling in over time. We're very happy to add Mina Kimes to our podcast network, and this universe is going to continue to grow. We're going to talk to people inside and outside of sports. If you want to check out previous stuff we've done with Neil Brennan and Adam McKay, you can. Joe Buck is going to be next week, but this week we're going back to the acting well, and we're going to get more comedians and musicians and athletes through here. But you know this guy from Whiplash. Maybe you know him as the famous hard-ass character in Oz, the Spider-Man movies. He's had a long career and has arrived at success now, and he's a grinder. And I want to talk to him about that and about what it was like to win an Academy Award after a lifetime of grinding in the acting field. J.K. Simmons joins us now, and check out his show Counterpart. It is on Starz right now. It's a passion project that he believes in. Here's J.K. Simmons. So the story of J.K. Simmons, and I like talking to the guys who have lived a big life in Hollywood, who have wisdom accrued over failures and struggles, and then they've arrived. And this guy's doing so well these days. He used to be singing Telegrams and the Yellow Peanut M&M. I guess he's still that. And grateful, but he's gone from, you know, the kindly dad or the stoic cop. He's become a Hollywood fixture for a variety of different ways and different things. J.K. Simmons with us. Counterpart on Starz, Sundays at 9 p.m. You could check it out. You have gone down this path, and you were struggling for a long time before you arrived at success. What was the story around A Few Good Men and how close you were to being something in A Few Good Men?
That's a great story of what seemed like heartbreak. What was heartbreak at the time? I was technically my second Broadway show. My first one was a little flop musical that ran 2 weeks. I went and auditioned for a replacement job in A Few Good Men to understudy the colonel and the doctor. I got hired. I was very happy. I was playing a grunt part and understudying the colonel and the doctor. I got a chance to go on. When I played the colonel, which people who saw the movie think of as the Jack Nicholson part, it was just one of the best marriages of actor and role that I'd ever experienced. It went great. Aaron Sorkin, who at that time was just some kid from Scarsdale who wrote a play, was excited about what I did with the part and blah, blah, blah. So a couple of weeks later, the actor who's playing the part is at the end of his contract. He's hitting the road. Everybody kind of assumes that I'll get to play the part. I end up not getting to play the part because they need to find somebody with a little, you know, TV and movie background that'll sell some tickets, and I'm certainly not that guy in 1990. And I was devastated. I was heartbroken. It just seemed so not fair, and I was still naive enough, I guess, at that time to think that, you know, that the right thing would happen. So I was bummed out. I went to my agent's office on Monday, and I said, I got to get out of here. Find me something else. I don't want to be playing a grunt, you know, watching somebody else get to play the role that I think, you know, I'm the right guy for. And the thing that he found for me was a revival of Peter Pan playing Captain Hook. And shortly after I joined that cast, a lovely young lady named Michelle Schumacher joined the cast to play Tiger Lily. And she is now my wife and the mother of our two adorable children.
Well, you have a few stories like that, right, that seemed like crushing failure at the time and then became something that was positive. How much were you changed by your kids? How much were you altered, your perspective, your life view?
Well, it's impossible to calculate because, at this point, it's impossible to imagine life without them. And right now, my wife and I are staring the empty nest in the face. Our son is off at college. Our daughter's a senior in high school. She'll be out of here in the fall doing her college thing, and we'll be on to the next stage, empty nesters.
Do you say that with freedom in mind? Do you say that with sadness? Do you say it with freedom, and your wife says it with sadness?
No, you know what? I think we're mostly on the same page, and I know, I know people have vastly different takes on it, but yeah, we're mostly kind of lamenting it. I mean, not that we won't have, some nice sort of couple time again, But, you know, we like having our kids around, and hopefully, you know, we'll stay close. Looks like, well, our son's at college in New York. Our daughter is hoping to be in school in New York. So my wife and I are definitely condo shopping in Manhattan again so we can stalk our kids.
When you are looking back at the struggles in theater, the times that you doubted that you weren't going to make it, that maybe you feel like you were putting down some of your dignity in the pursuit, I'm thinking of the Singing Telegram. Where along the line there did you do the doubting thing?
I did the doubting thing off and on for several years, and as it turns out, it's fortunate that I didn't really have any other reasonably saleable skill other than washing cars or waiting tables or whatever sort of, you know, relatively menial job I was doing to pay the rent when I didn't have a little acting job. I mean, I hesitate to use the word struggles because a lot of that time, I mean, when I was waiting tables, I was, you know, whatever, I'm waiting tables and I'm, you know, getting free food and taking home a pocket full of crumpled up ones and paying the rent on my crappy sublet in Hell's Kitchen. And I got friends and family and life's okay. And then when I get a play for $215 a week in Albany, then that's great, and I'm living the dream and loving life. I'm not banking a lot of cash, but for a long time I was a single guy with no responsibilities, and you know, I had a roof over my head, and I was doing what I wanted to do, not all the time, but enough of the time to keep me kind of on that path.
There was no plan B? Like, it was either acting or bust?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, when I was in college, I was studying music, and I initially was going to get my music education degree at the same time as I got my music performance degree in voice and composition and all that. But then I went in to see the chairman of the department, who also happened to be my dad, and had a conversation about, because I was like, you know what, I'm kind of ready to be out of here. And I didn't love my student teaching experience. So, you know, what if I just got the music degree and not the music ed degree? How long would that take? And we kind of looked at the course requirements, and you say, well, yeah, you could be out of here in another 2 quarters, and then you could get the hell out of my house. And, cause I was living back at home with mom and dad, the last couple of years of college after being away from home. Yeah, so once I made that decision that I didn't have the teaching gene, which, my father was a teacher, my sister's a teacher, my brother's a teacher. Yeah, there was really not much else other than, like I said, relatively menial, and I wasn't even that good at most of the, like, I'm using the word menial and I'm thinking about waiting tables, and I'm thinking, it's kind of hard to call that menial, because now as a customer going to restaurants, it's like most of the people who are doing that for a living are a lot better at it than I was. I was a barely competent, moderately charming, but not all that well organized waiter. So I was one of those guys who would make 3 trips when somebody with a better memory could have made 1 trip.
He's gotten much better at efficiency. Tune into Counterpart on Stars. Is so efficient, he's playing multiple characters. It's not just one character he's playing on Counterpart. He's decided, nah, I could play many because I can spin a lot of plates because I'm J.K. Simmons. You mentioned the $215. Where does that rank in terms of checks you remember with the fondest memory? Because being paid $215 to act feels like the arrival at a dream, even though it's funny to look back at it in retrospect.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the first one I remember was $60 a week. That was my first paycheck at the Big Fork Summer Playhouse in Big Fork, Montana. Still a going concern up there in Big Fork, by the way. Still run by the same family. 1977, I was the music director and a company member, cast member, and we did 4 musicals in rep, and yeah, man, $60 a week. Are you kidding me? What am I going to do with all that money?
And so how about later in life? What are the checks you remember where you're like, are you kidding me? Like, when you arrive at the Oscars, you, man, JK, tell me some people who have done more grinding than you in Hollywood. Like, you didn't arrive the mountaintop. You did, like, the waiter. You made 3 trips. Like, you were making a lot of trips to get to that mountaintop, to get to Oscar night.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go all Sisyphus on you, but yeah, there was a lot of grinding. Grinding is an accurate term there. And again, loving it when I was doing it. And it just fortunately coincided that about the time I met my wife and we got married and decided to have a family, that was about the time that I started actually making some money and I could afford to be responsible enough to put a roof over the heads of somebody besides myself.
Who is the character you've played that you've most brought home with you?
You know what? This is we're going to come back. It was Vern Schillinger on Oz because it took so long. I mean, that was really, I'd done a few things on camera before, but that was my first big thing in television and film, and obviously that's a character that is a pretty big departure from myself as a human being. So it was a real process kind of getting into the skin of that guy, and especially the first season, it really took me a while to shake it off at the end of the day, you know, playing that guy. And I think it was when we went back for season two, for me and for a lot of us, I remember having this conversation with Harold Perrineau too, you know, that was like, we got to learn to lighten up. I mean, it looks like we're going to be playing these characters for a while, and 12 hours a day in this skin is really enough. You just got to learn to sort of shed that skin like a snake before you get on the subway to go home.
Was it similar with Whiplash?
Well, Whiplash was so immediate and so short term. We shot that entire film in 19 days.
Are you kidding me?
Dude, when we were doing like Q&As after screenings of the movie and stuff, sort of at the beginning of the whole award season thing, Damien and I, or Miles and I, or all three of us, invariably somebody would ask a question and one of us would say, well, the whole shoot was 19 days, and this like group gasp would come up in the audience, which was mostly pretty knowledgeable film buffs. Yeah, 19 days. I mean, just unbelievable. And of course, when I had like 2.5 days off in there, Miles was there pretty much every minute of every day. Yeah, that was crazy. I mean, that was like we were all prepared. I mean, most of my preparation for that really was learning music because we really wanted it to be sort of accurate and believable.
What do you mean learn music? You didn't know music? You had to learn music and then boom, 19 days.
No,
here, don't make the movie everyone's going to remember you by.
I mean, I have a background in music. I have a degree in music. I had to learn all those tunes that we were playing, all those charts, so that I could, so that I'm not just some actor up there waving my arms around. All those people that you see playing instruments in that film, all of those people were musicians who actually played. It's not the final mix that you're hearing, but every time we were doing a take, we were playing music, and I was actually leading the band, you know. So I really felt like, and especially, you know, being a guy who went to music school, you know, it was like that credibility was important to me as an actor and as a musician, and then very much so for Miles too, who'd been playing drums since he was 15 years old. I mean, it was like the music scenes were the times when I really kind of felt the pressure, and the acting scenes when I'm just ripping Miles a new hole, you know, that was just fun.
What was the thing that you liked about Whiplash? Like, I'm sure you liked many things, but the thing that drew you to the project and the thing that you liked best about the completed version?
It's such a tie. I love the story that Damien laid out there, and the first thing that we talked about when we sat down to talk about me playing the part in the short film, which we did almost a year and a half before the feature, was that ambiguity. That this guy, it would be very easy for my character to be perceived as, again, sort of a two-dimensional bad guy. He's the bad guy, and Miles Teller's character is the protagonist and the good guy and the sort of victim in all of this. But we really both wanted to strive for a kind of ambiguity there where it's like, this guy is a brilliant artist, and everything that he's doing is to achieve greatness creatively. And whether you can justify the human cost or not, there should be at least some discussion and debate about that, about whether this guy is just a raving ass and a sadist and a bastard, or whether he's a great artist who is expecting greatness out of others. That sort of central debate was what I really loved about that.
Let's pause for a second with J.K. Simmons to give some love to the people who help keep this stuff free. We want you to support our sponsors. Mike is trying to interrupt me. I'm sitting here trying to talk to J.K. Simmons, and Mike can't wait to get in here.
We know who's playing in the big game. There's opportunities here to make some money, man. To make some money, and I want to talk to you about one of these opportunities, man, because it's a big game. You love fantasy football, don't you? Well, you don't, but I do, and there's only one place to play it when it comes to the big game, Dan.
Are we talking about the Super Bowl?
We're not allowed to say that. Good work by you, jackass.
We'll bleep it.
Okay, very good. Yes, that is what we're talking about, you oaf. DraftKings, go ahead and tell them, Mike. DraftKings, tell them the bullet points so people can support DraftKings. Way to go, Chris. Excellent contribution. Jesus Christ.
Well, you don't want to miss out on your final chance to play fantasy football this season with the single game showdown. It's the newest way to play at DraftKings. And you know, DraftKings, I've been telling you all the time, even though this is the first time I've spoken to you about DraftKings, that it's a leader in daily fantasy sports. For the big game, DraftKings is hosting a fantasy football contest that has a $1 million top prize if you sign up with the promo code. And this is very important. You better use this promo code. Beach.
Beach.
As in South Beach Sessions,
yeah.
Beach, B-E-A-C-H. That's your promo code. Okay, people, I need you to do that. And remember all the great things that DraftKings provides. Like your captain, it gets 1.5 times the points as all the rest of the players. Why not be even more invested in this big game?
What is this call to action? DraftKings.com, download the app. What is this call to action?
A call to action, Dan, is lingo in the biz. That's the point that you got to hammer home. You're doing so well on this spot.
I wasn't supposed to say it was
call to action.
Call me to action.
DraftKings.com or download the app for a limited time. Use the code BEACH to enter the all-new Super Game Showdown contest free with your first deposit. I know I said super, but I didn't say the other word. That's key in all of this. You need to compete in this $1 million challenge for the top prize. That's a top prize of $1 million.
Enough. You're shouting. Like, just stop. This is a relaxed podcast with that delicate music and stuff. Like, knock it down a notch.
But use the code BEACH. I'm telling you.
All right, BEACH. Help us out by BEACH. My father, it's the way my father pronounces female dogs. Any other bullet points?
Yeah, it's a game inside of a game, and it's a minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details.
Okay, right. So we return more quietly. God, that was aggressive. It ruined the entire energy. I salute you, Chris, though, for being that awful that efficiently. We return now to J.K. Simmons. When you were typecast, and I don't know how long you were getting typecast, but what would you say you are more like, the stoic cop or the kindly dad? If you have to pick the one that you look like and that is not represents your personality, because I think we know you're the kindly dad, but that you say, okay, the typecast is fair, which one is it, the stoic cop or the kindly dad?
Well, I guess typecasting looks wise, and really a lot of it, I think, has to do with the voice, too. Probably the stoic cop.
Yeah, you've been very good. Do you have a favorite stoic cop that you've been?
Well, my favorite cop that I played is the only real life cop that I played, which was Sergeant Jeffrey Pugliese of the Watertown Police Department in Patriots Day, which was the recreation of the actual events surrounding the Boston Marathon bombings of a few years ago.
Poetic license, right? With some controversial poetic license, because I think I've read that the Wahlberg character didn't actually exist, right?
Well, the Wahlberg character, I hope it's not really controversial. The Wahlberg character, admittedly, going in, was a combination of three different characters, really. So everything that we did from my perspective, and believe me, Pete Berg, who has made several of these kinds of films, and a few of them with Mark, Lone Survivor, for crying out loud, you know, I mean, these guys know what they're doing when they're recreating real events. From my perspective, Pete and I went back and forth all the time, and as I got to spend time with Jeff Pugliese and learn directly from him and from the other guys in his department who would assure me, oh, no, he's not... He's not making this up. This is what really went down, and this is what he really did. And it was absolutely number one goal to recreate the events exactly as they unfolded. And I know that Mark's character, you know, seemed like, oh, wow, he magically appears – every time there's action going on. I mean, and that was the dramatic license there. But in terms of the way the victims were treated, the way the bad guys were treated, and the way my specific character and most of the specific characters were treated in that movie, accuracy was the number one goal.
Is there a character that J.K. Simmons has played that the family makes fun of him about?
Well, yeah. I mean, most of them, I'm gonna say, at one point or another. Although my family, and by my family, I mean my kids now at this point, pretty much make fun of me more in real life than on screen.
But there's not one that the family laughs about. I'm not thinking of any in particular. I'm allowing you to select whichever one it is that the family asks you about or teases you about. Is there ever a time that a kid might talk back to you and be like, okay, Commissioner Gordon of Justice League?
I guess it would be the singing telegram guy, probably.
Yeah, that guy. We enjoy the idea of you doing singing telegrams and parlaying that into Oscar night. What did Oscar night feel like for you? Can you even explain that? If you're willing to acknowledge the idea that you've been an acting grinder and you're a thespian, you care about it, you pour yourself into it. But what was Oscar night like for you?
Everybody I knew who knows anything about show business and awards and those kinds of things, which I mostly have not ever paid much attention to, assured me that there was no way it wasn't going to be me. Now I'm thinking like the 30 for 30 that's going on with Buster Douglas about the Tyson fight, 42-1. So I was thinking, I don't want to be Mike Tyson. I'm thinking if they announce my category and they don't say my name, I'm going to feel like the biggest schmuck on the planet. Because everybody keeps telling me, oh, dude, it's absolutely, there's no doubt. It's,
you know, wow, so J.K. Simmons walks into Oscar night smug, knowing, like, with the expectation that he is going to win Oscar.
No, not smug, with the expectation of everybody else sort of on my shoulders, so that, honestly, when Lupita said my name, it was like this giant sigh of relief. And, you know, I kissed my wife and stumbled up onto the stage and almost ran down the Steadicam guy. And by the way, I think you can find this on YouTube. I slightly, as I was accepting the trophy, and went to shake Lupita's hand and then went, oh, no, that's right. We're in Hollywood and I have to do the fake kiss on the cheek. I headbutted Lupita. A little bit of a headbutt. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube.
Okay, we will. I'm sure our audience will. Graceful in a moment of triumph.
Oh, yes.
Was there any interaction from that night that had you going, well, how the hell did I get here? Are you kidding me?
Oh, well, the whole thing was surreal in that way. Yeah. And then because it was all new to me, I mean, they announced the Supporting Actor Award very early in the proceedings, and then I'm walking off stage with this Oscar, and suddenly there's like 45 minutes or so of getting whisked around and ushered here and ushered there and doing little interviews backstage and photos and this and that. And it's like, you know, you're being led by both elbows in your nose.
You're basically talking about Oscar night, J.K., and this is funny that you're doing this. You're basically saying it was a combination of relief and being dragged around by the nose, which is not how I imagined it.
Well, you know, and wearing a nice suit, and my wife wearing an amazingly beautiful dress, and looking like a fairy princess.
Speaking of your fairy princess, you are working with her now, working professionally with her. Has that had its challenges? Is that something that you've done before, or is writing and directing now with her something that you've just decided, oh, I want a challenge with The Empty Nest?
Well, no. We met, you know, as peers doing theater, and that's the aforementioned Peter Pan revival, and we worked again on stage together in the Neil Simon play Laughter on the 23rd Floor. And then once she started making babies, well, I did my part as well. She firmly wanted to be a full-time mom, so she was just out of the business for a while, especially when the kids were little. And then rather than try to sort of kickstart her acting career, she got interested in writing and directing and being on the other side of the camera, and made a few tiny little short films for zero budget, and that's ultimately blossomed into she co-wrote and co-produced and directed this film, I'm Not Here, which is going to be out in theaters in March. Select cities, kind of a release, you know, a beautiful little independent film drama that I am one of the stars of, along with Sebastian Stan and Ian Armitage. The three of us play the same character at different ages in his life.
And how does that work, though, working with your wife? Creative disagreements, tensions, when you want to go after the way that you want to go after a director off-Broadway the way you did when you were a young diva? Like, what does that look like?
Well, let me say, there were really only two examples that sprung to my mind of having a heated debate with a director, and neither of them was with my spouse.
Okay.
It was a relationship that just felt very, I mean, you know, there's the old joke about, I was just like at home, you know, I just do whatever the hell she tells me to do. But honestly, she was so prepared, and even in her early projects, and especially with this one, I'm Not Here, you know, really had the respect of her crew, and by the time I got to the set to shoot my portion of the movie, they'd already shot half the movie. It was a well-oiled machine, and she was the captain of the ship, and I just went where I was pointed and did my thing.
Was that in some ways the most rewarding and fulfilling of some of the work that you've done, given who you were sharing it with, given the parts of the story that you've told us, that your heartbreak ended up with you finding the family and the life that you ended up choosing? Like, I can't imagine what kind of fulfillment there is in working with your wife after parenting, after she let go of some of her dreams to be a mom on something that is your original creative love.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the best of both worlds. And our kids actually both took part in it to some extent, too. Our daughter did a little, I'm not going to try and, you know, paint it differently than it is. She was a background actor. She was an extra. Although now she's got the bug and she wants to be an actor. And our son, who's a budding musician, contributed some to the soundtrack of the movie. My wife's brother was her co-producer, and it was a real family affair and a real passion project on the part of my wife, and who has a name, by the way, Michelle Schumacher. I don't know if I put that out there yet. She and her writing partner really had a passion for telling this story about this character who, when I play him, is a sad alcoholic, you know, regretful guy sort of lamenting about what he's made of his life. And then as we do flashbacks and examine the story of this guy's life, it ultimately becomes this, what does it become? I don't want to spoil anything. It's just a beautiful story about love and the possibility of redemption and forgiveness.
What is something on a darker note that you hate about Hollywood that just makes you crazy? It's not for you. I don't know that I see the dramatic in you. I'm not sure I see the Hollywood in you, but I'm judging a book by its cover. So maybe that's fair. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe you're at all the Vogue parties. Maybe you're doing all the insincere kissing of celebrities that accidentally end up in headbutts. I don't know.
You know, I think insincerity would be the main thing. I felt like all those years that I was in New York and you know, even the quote unquote struggling, you know, early on when I was waiting tables and then doing regional theater in Buffalo or wherever. In New York, I always felt like there was a level of directness and honesty there, even in showbiz. And I felt like when I came to L.A., and really when I came to L.A., you know, I'd already was at a level of success and good fortune that I had never imagined I would be. But there is a little, you know, in New York, they'll stab you in the chest. In L.A., they'll stab you in the back. That to me was...
And you like the chest better. You like to see it coming. You prefer to see it coming. A guy as buff as you, a guy who lifts weights, if you're going to stab me, please do it in the chest. Let's do it man style. I'm the character in Oz. I'm the character in Whiplash. How about you not do it in my back?
Yes.
What is the character, or what is the thing that fans most want to talk to you about? Like, is there anything that's a weight? I understand that, you know, you're grateful for the success of these things, but is there anything that you just wish people would stop asking you?
I mean, you know, there's stuff I could whine about, but as you said, you know, I'm so grateful for the good fortune I've had in my career, and more importantly, in my life, that, you know, I'm not going to whine about somebody walking up to me on the street and going, you know, hey, bum-ba-dum-bum-bum-bum-bum. And usually they don't even sing it that well, by the way. The people who want to do the Farmers Insurance jingle to me, I don't know, some of the, let me put it this way, my Whiplash character would probably throw a chair at them.
I am being forced by executive edict to stop this soul probing of J.K. Simmons for a second so that we can shill for one of our sponsors because it keeps all this stuff free and expanding. Mike, I'd really like to get back to opening the chest cavity of J.K. Simmons.
Well, priorities, Dan. Priorities, because I'm ticked off, because there are people out there that are not smart. These job sites that are out there that aren't ZipRecruiter, okay, job sites that make you wait for the right people to apply for your job.
They hire poorly, most people.
Oh, man, job boards that assume qualified candidates will just see the listing and apply for your job. There has to be a smarter way than this.
Yeah.
Guys, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. Whoa. They're all the smartest. They
get
the best of the best people.
You found a smarter way? You were competent and found a smarter way as soon as Mike said there must be a smarter way?
No schlubs. No Chris Cody's around there.
No nepotism there?
Nope.
Oh, guys, I just typed in ZipRecruiter.com/beach, and guess what?
What?
This is a smart way to do it.
Hey.
I can hire the right person using this. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for me.
All right, yeah.
Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the right skills, education, and experience, and then it actively invites them to apply to this job.
Where'd they get good ratings, Mike?
Oh, they got good ratings, and it's rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews.
Why are you talking again?
I'm just so angry because people do not work smart.
That podcast tones are tranquil. Okay. It's a serene time. It's intimate. Like you're just shouting at people. If I were someone from ZipRecruiter, I would not be happy with the way that you were yelling and fouling up the energy around.
This is more NPR-y. Okay, I will do that. It is the South Beach Sessions. We'll get back to J.K. Simmons, but I just want our South Beach Session listeners right now to try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's B-E-A-C-H.
The way to support us the best is to do what Mike just said.
ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's very important.
Show them that beach is the reason you're there so they see that their advertising works. No more bullet points. I want to get back to J.K. Simmons. Back off, please. Back the f*** off and allow me to do this J.K. Simmons interview.
ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire.
J.K., can you tell us a little bit about a check that you got one time where you were mailbox or direct deposit? You look at it and you're like, holy shit.
There have definitely been a few rungs on that ladder along the way where I got paychecks that kind of boggled my mind. But the first one that comes to mind was when we did the first Spider-Man movie with Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire and, you know, that whole gang. And my agent negotiated the deal, you know, after they offered me the part of J. Jonah Jameson, and it was very exciting. And we made a deal because it was a, you know, a smallish part. It was a daily rate, almost like you work for as a very, very small bit player in a movie, just a sort of higher daily rate. And I was just, my mind was blown. I'm going to make that much per day on this movie? That's crazy talk. And then about days after the deal was done, my agent gleefully called me because he said, I just got a call from the business affairs guy on the movie, and he forgot that they're supposed to tie you up for two sequels as well. So guess who's in the driver's seat now? And he's rubbing his hands together. So yeah, then the deal that he put together for Spider-Man 2 and 3 was just,
Now it can be said, no one has made as much off of Spider-Man as J.K. Simmons. Now it can be told.
Well, I don't think that's accurate, but it was mind-boggling at the time, for sure.
Counterpart on Stars, what is it that drew you to that project? Why are you playing multiple characters? One's not hard enough?
Yeah, I should have known. And honestly, my agent, the same agent who, gleefully negotiated the Spider-Man deal, when he sent that to me, as has become our pattern and my preference, I ask him to just send me a script. Don't send me, I don't want to know the synopsis and, all the details about it. I just want to read the script so I can experience it beginning to end. So I'm reading this script, and I'm meeting this character named Howard. And, he told me Howard is the character that interested in you playing. And I'm just kind of being pulled into this world by Justin Mark's writing and really empathizing with this character who's kind of a sad sack and a sweet, kind, underachieving kind of guy in this dystopian kind of place. And then on page 20 or, you know, whatever it was, suddenly, this is a gigantic spoiler, so if you want to start the show from the beginning, stop listening for 30 seconds. We suddenly meet this identical or seemingly identical version of the character who has crossed over from a parallel world. And I was just, my mind was blown just reading it on the page. And I thought, oh, wow. So I would be playing this guy that I've already sort of come to really love and identify with, but I would also be playing this sort of badass version of the same guy. That sounds like it would be an interesting challenge. It actually reminded me of the days back in New York when I would, you know, I would go in the morning play the shrink on Law and Order, and then in the afternoon play the psychotic, murdering, white supremacist bastard in the afternoon on Oz.
How many bad scripts do you read? Have you gotten any more efficient at that, or are you still the inefficient waiter? Like, are you getting nothing but good scripts these days, or are you reading a lot of crap?
Listen, the biggest results from all the awards a few years ago for Whiplash was that there are more and more and more opportunities coming my way. The percentage, I read a lot of stuff that I just think, you know. But I, you know, I also read a lot of stuff that I go, well, this is really, you know, smart and good and interesting, but I don't think, it's not just a question of finding something good and saying, yes, I'll do it, because it also has to be something that I find a connection with, that I feel like I can be the guy to do this, and that's not like exactly like something I just got done doing, because I don't want to always be repeating myself. So there's a lot that goes into it. But yeah, just separating the good from the bad, or the good from the less good, is the first step. And obviously that's as subjective as anything.
What's the most surprised you've been by the result of what you're making? Because every time we talk to actors, they almost never know whether something they're doing is good or not in the movies, not necessarily on Broadway.
No, it is definitely hard to tell oftentimes in films. I mean, there are exceptions to that rule. Whiplash was one of them. You know, I mean, I had absolutely no idea that Whiplash would get anywhere near the attention that it got, but I knew it was going to be a really, really, really good movie. More often to me, it's something that happens in between reading the script and signing on. It's something that happens sort of during the execution of something where I find sort of one little disappointment after another, or just things that are sometimes the way I saw something when I was reading a script is not the way the director and the producers and the other cast are seeing things. I mean, there's always this sort of negotiation going on during the process of shooting. But sometimes you also sort of see compromises being made and see budget restrictions coming in from the studio, or just see that you and the director are really not entirely on the same page. And then while trying to be open to that sort of collaborative process and not always sort of insisting my idea is always the best, you try to find ways to get back on the same page. But then, of course, at the end of the day, you leave it in the editor and director's hands for how it's going to ultimately be put together. And that can be, especially initially, like, you know, when I was first starting to do film and TV after doing theater for 20 years, you know, I would watch something that I was in and go, and, you know, smaller parts, obviously, and I would go, oh, wow, now it's a really, really, really small part, just in terms of chunks that were cut, or even in terms of, wow, we did 3 takes of that camera angle, and why did they choose that one? Because I don't believe myself in that take. And I, you know, that continues now. I mean, see, I watch final cuts of things, and there are always little things that I miss.
Gene Hackman, you know, can't watch himself. He's too critical of himself. He hates everything.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that comes into it is because I'm critical of the way things are put together and the way things are edited and this and that, and also really starting from the beginning, the first thing I did on camera, the first really significant thing I did on camera from my perspective was a guest star part on Homicide, Life on the Street, Tom Fontana's show that, you know, a year or two later led to me doing Us. And it was a great guest star part, brilliant writing. And it was a character that led to me playing Vern Schillinger. He was a neo-Nazi murdering bastard, ex-military guy. And I was playing scenes with Andre Brower and Kyle Secor. And it was thrilling and terrifying. And during the shoot, Ed Sheeran was our director, he's a legendary New York producer-director. It was completely all-consuming. And then when it came out on TV, this was in the old VCR days, I recorded the episode and I dissected every second of my work in that episode. And I would watch part of the scene and I would stop and I would rewind and I would go back and I would look at myself and I would go, oh, that was, you know, that was not a good, I just don't believe myself in that moment, or I lost focus in that moment, or whatever, and be learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot just being there and playing the scenes with those other great actors. But I've sort of gone almost full circle from that. I must have watched 12 hours watching my 12 minutes on that show. I now tend to a little bit more along the Gene Hackman lines. I mean, first of all, it's not like I'm a gorgeous Hollywood starlet, but it's hard to watch yourself age on camera, no matter what.
Well, that was that was Hackman's thing. Like, look, man, you look good. You look good for anybody at any age. You look good. But that was Hackman's thing. He's like, I hated looking at myself.
Yeah, it gets, and then you find, you know, as a lot of people do, especially when you're in the public eye, you look at the one or two or three things about your physical appearance. And you kind of go, I mean, if I had a genie and a lamp and three wishes, here's the three things I would change about my face or my body or my whatever, you know. Sometimes it's like that's all you can see. I mean, I'll be watching something and all I'm staring at is the part of my body that I just get weird and self-conscious about. So, you know, it can be hard on that level. And also it's just, I mean, I've been doing this a really long time now, and not that I don't still have something to learn like I did from watching that episode of Homicide.
You don't have to watch 12 minutes for 12 hours anymore. The grinder is no less hungry because he's not the crazy person he was when he was so vain and so insecure that he had to do 12 minutes for 12 hours.
Beautifully put, sir. Thank you so much.
Okay, so tune in to Counterpart on Starz Sunday at 9 p.m., okay? Check him out because we want to support the people who support us, and J.K. Simmons has been good to our show for a while. I've just got a couple of quick rapid-fire questions for you before we get you out of here. Where is the Oscar? Where is it?
The Oscar is on a bookshelf in the second floor of our house, surrounded by photos of the kids and other knickknacks. But it's upstairs, not like on display for everybody that walks into the house, only for the close personal friends who get invited upstairs.
Can J.K. Simmons just call somebody and have M&Ms sent to them, like an enormous amount of M&Ms sent to them because of your deal?
Yes.
Ah, nice. What is the thing that you can do, 63-year-old J.K. Simmons can do in the weight room that still is something that the young people here listening don't understand that a J.K. Simmons can do? He'll wipe your ass. He will wipe your head. Wait, let me try again. He will wipe the floor with your ass on the weight room. J.K. Simmons, what's the thing you can do?
At this point, my great accomplishment is, after being put through my paces in the weight room, actually being able to walk out of the weight room.
Didn't you hurt yourself at Mardi Gras? Didn't you hurt yourself throwing beads at Mardi Gras? What happened to you, man? You're a stoic cop. You're like the hero of Patriot. Like, what happened? You're hurting yourself throwing beads?
Right. It was like my first throw off the bus, too. It was like 2 days before the big parade. I just made an awkward backhand sort of frisbee throw at some kid who was standing there, and yeah, totally tweaked my shoulder. It's one of the reasons I'm grateful walking out of the weight room that I'm still in one piece. But I think I do have another shoulder scoping in my not too distant future, unfortunately.
Oh no! Last question here. The person who has played a neo-Nazi better than me on the silver screen is blank.
I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to. Well, first of all, I don't, like, watch much movies or TV. unless it's the Detroit Tigers or the Ohio State University football team, or the Dan Levitard show, obviously. I don't watch that much, so I'm gonna totally back off. And
that's quite all right for you to back off. I will remind everyone, you and the audience, that I just said that this guy we admire, J.K. Simmons, he will wipe your ass. That's something that I just did during this podcast. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I did that to you, J.K., but you've worked with a lot of...
You know what? There's a very, very short list of people for whom I have done that. And they're all either my own children or nieces and nephews or the children of my very closest friends.
Okay, so I'm slightly less good a writer than Aaron Sorkin. J.K., thank you. I'm not kidding, okay? First, two things. I'm not kidding. You should watch Counterpart on Stars Sundays, 9 p.m. Eastern. And I'm not kidding. J.K. Simmons will wipe your ass.
Beautiful.
See you later, J.K. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
Our thanks to J.K. Simmons for being introspective there. It's what we're trying to do with these things in a longer form, make them intimate, make you know a little bit about the person. Next week, we're going to go back to sports. Joe Buck is going to be our guest next week. He's funny and he's got some stories to tell. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review because we need your support on these things. Just go do it this way. Let's just foul up the whole system. Subscribe, rate, and review, then unsubscribe, and subscribe again and rate and review.